Vampire, der Podcast über Frauen, die schreiben.
Mein heutiger Gast ist Rumana Bujarowska. Sie ist Schriftstellerin, Übersetzerin, Herausgeberin, Aktivistin, Veranstalterin und Professorin für amerikanische Literatur aus Skopje in Mazedonien. Ihr Short-Story-Band »Mein Mann« erschien 2021 im Surkamp Verlag, ist aber schon seit sehr vielen Jahren ein internationaler Bestseller, der in viele Sprachen übersetzt wurde, unter anderem auch ins Englische unter dem Titel »My Husband« und erscheint auch nächstes Jahr auf Französisch, ist auf der Bühne adaptiert worden und auch teilweise verfilmt. Auf dem Balkan ist sie eine feministische Ikone. In ihrer Radiosendung »Peach Preach« diskutiert sie seit vielen Jahren kontroverse Themen wie zum Beispiel Diskriminierung von Frauen im Gesundheitssystem, Queer Rights und die Frauenfeindlichkeit in der Medienwelt. Außerdem ist sie eine meiner engsten Freundinnen. Das Gespräch führen wir auf Englisch und deshalb, without further ado, welcome to Vampire, my dear Rumana.
Hello! So nice to hear you.
Oh, I'm so happy that we're finally doing the podcast that we've dreamed of for, 2 years now?
Oh, for many, many years, yeah. Yeah, so let's just do the disclaimer right up front. You and I, we're very close friends and we talk basically on a daily basis, just in case people are listening and wondering what are these women even talking about. We wanted to talk about Roxane Gay, you and I was, to get this, to start us off, I just remembered you and I, like, I want to introduce her or our love, mutual love for her, with a text conversation you and I had a few months ago, which now that I read it back was actually hilarious. So you were invited to the ILB, the International Berlin Literary Festival, in September, and a few weeks or months maybe when you got the invite and when you were reading through all the emails, who else is going to be there, you discovered that Roxane Gay is going to be at the festival. And send me a text, and you and I, we basically turned into psycho stalkers and completely flipped out and were determined to find out how we can meet her, maybe at least for a couple of minutes. A couple of minutes later, you discovered that she's going to only take part remotely. So that was a bit of a bust. And I think we both cried a little bit.
That was a very, very rapid burst of the bubble that we, of our fantasy that we invented in those 2 minutes. Because I saw you and me going and like stalking her and trying to meet her. But it was, and then I was thinking, you know, there's this, I love this line in Catcher in the Rye, where Salinger talks, actually Holden Caulfield talks about how when you really like an author, you kind of feel like you should call them up on the phone and talk to them. And that's kind of how I feel about Roxane Gay. And so I imagine just having the ability of you and me going there and saying hello to her would have been really something completely special.
Yeah, that was really the quickest burst of a literary orgasm that I ever had, I think. That was really weird. But I mean, I share that enthusiasm because I actually have imagined multiple times running into her at the airport or something. Like, I always imagined what it would be like if I ran into her, if I could muster up the courage to talk to her and be all fangirly and ask her to sign my plane ticket or something. But we jumped in right away, which is great. So I was wondering if you can maybe like introduce her to us and to all of us listening, just like with a couple of sentences, and maybe share how you got into her in the first place and how you first came to know her and what ignited your love for her. That would be great.
You know what? I think maybe you ignited my love for her.
Oh, I'm seriously? Not sure. Oh my God. Okay.
Yeah. I'm not sure. You talked about hunger, but I don't know. I really don't know. I know that you really loved her, and I thought, and you talked about hunger, and I said, okay, I'm gonna just order hunger. And I had Bad Feminist, but I had read some essays, I think, from that, but I can't remember where I got to read her, and I've never read her stories or her novel. I think there's one called An Untamed State or something. And I just kind of jumped into her essays in Bad Feminist. And then we talked about hunger, and you really expressed your fascination with that book. So then I started reading it. And of course, you know, you have a very good, I really trust your judgment on books.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, I want to say this on the record.
Recorded, noted.
Yeah, I've never, you know, everything that you've so far recommended has been amazing. Or I've said, oh, I've read this, and then you've said, oh, you should continue reading that. And so then I think it was like, you know, like I think 3 or 4 years ago, I had not read Joan Didion when we met.
Mm. Remember? Oh, yeah, I remember. Yeah, that's another love we share also.
Yes. And I took, when we met in Iowa at the international writing program at this residency that we both got. So we spent 3 months in Iowa City and in the same hotel. We lived in very desolate hotel rooms for 3 months with in an old building where also Carver and Cheever had lived and had drunk a lot. Presumably because really there was nothing else to do there as well. But those is probably in the days where you could also smoke, where we didn't have that privilege. But I think it was, I took an essay course. Well, I sat into an essay, sat in an essay course for the students who were taking the prestigious writing program, the creative writing program at Iowa University. Not for, you know, we were in the international writing program, but there's another
there's
one,
this very famous Iowa University creative writing program that's really renowned, and Marian Robinson was heading it for the longest time. And and this Iowa writing program, they every year they host a bunch of international writers from all over the world for the so-called international writing program. And this is where you and I met in 2018, which is a lifetime ago now, with the pandemic and everything. Yeah, so, and then you, yeah, I remember that you went and you sat in a couple of classes, and yeah, so you sat in a nonfiction class.
Yes, it was like an essay course, I think. And then they had a couple of Didion essays that they were looking at. And I thought, why don't I know this? But of course, it's a little different when you live in a place like Macedonia, which doesn't have libraries that have new books, that order new books. So, and even recently now we have a new bookshop with English titles, but they're very expensive for our budget, let's say, or our standard of living. So I would normally have to order all of those books on my own, or I don't know, it's a little bit difficult to stay in touch with new things that are happening here in the world sometimes, because they don't get translated and you don't get them physically easily. And I'm really sick of reading stuff online, and I really don't like using Kindles. So I think sometimes it's, you know, when I'm abroad, for instance, I just try to learn as much as I can and catch up about things that maybe I haven't really known. And it was weird because no one reads Didion here. That's so unusual. I'm going to translate a couple of essays with my students so that, you know, maybe I can get some people hooked on her. But yeah, I really didn't read much nonfiction. And then I think it started with that class, and you'd read a lot. And you also preceded my my obsession with RuPaul's Drag Race and reality television.
Which again circles back to Roxane Gay, because she also, we share her love for reality television, not she shares our love, like she's the queen. So she got us into multiple disciplines, shall we say, like newspaper articles, TV shows, films, and but you mentioned Hunger when you started to talk about her. So Hunger is basically her memoir about her. I think the subtitle is The Story of My Body or Let's something. See. Yeah, you have it there.
A Memoir of My Body.
Yeah,
a Memoir of My
and
Body.
It's already brilliant. So can you talk a little bit about what that book did for you, like in terms of also of writing? Because I'm curious. you write fiction, but you're also a public person. You're a very vocal feminist, both in Macedonia and also online. So, of course, internationally. And so you mentioned that nonfiction wasn't in your wheelhouse before. So can you talk a little bit about what that book did for you? Because I remember that you were equally struck when you read it as much as I was.
Yes. Yes, I remember. I'm sorry. I mean, it's like this is very personal, but like how I go back and forth and telling and talking about how reading Roxane Gay is somehow connected to talking to you.
No, I mean, in the end, let's just say it's, I mean, this is also one of the aims of what we're doing here, or what I'm trying to do here, is to create this, let's say, circle of women writers who learn from each other and just get into conversations and talk about texts that we feel speak to us in a language and on topics that just concern us and that we think are universal. And I think it's always so interesting to have international writers such as yourself to compare and to talk about this with, because it just goes to show that these issues that these writers talk about are also completely international and don't necessarily relate only to a certain culture or a certain country.
Absolutely. And I think it's important. It's that as women writers, especially when we have public conversations like this, it becomes known that we talk about books a lot, and a lot of the conversations that we have are very frequently revolve very frequently around the books that we read and the recommendations that we give each other, and very frequently these are new women writers. I realized with talking to you and Lana Bastasic, for instance.
Who also is going to be on this podcast in at some point very soon. So just as a footnote. Anyway, yeah. So yeah, Hunger.
We do talk about these things, and the way in which we talk about them, I mean, the way I'm talking about it now, it kind of also goes back to Roxane Gay, because she has this way of speaking about social issues that is, of course, very personal. And you can see this in Bad Feminist, in the essays, but also in Hunger. She will begin each chapter sometimes, or the essay, by relating a personal experience. Mm-hmm. When I was 12, or when I was 8, this and this happened to me, or this is how I felt, or there was this boy in school, or I wanted to be popular, or I had a friend, etc. Mm. And I think this is crucial when you're writing nonfiction, at least for me. It's crucial that I get involved in the author's perspective of the social issue through their openly relating an experience that somehow is connected to the issue that they are discussing. So I think it's a great trick always, mm-hmm. because personally, it's the personal story, the intimate story always draws readers in. So, so she does this thing in Hunger as well, where she talks about her experience as an overweight Black woman, and she puts this into a social context and how this, in fact, makes her feel full of shame and also somehow makes her feel invisible because she's not important. She doesn't have social currency, as she says, because in this society, thinness, she says at one point, represents social currency. But also she's going into this very vivid, personal, extremely intimate, very tragic, moving account of how she feels as an overweight woman. Actually, she's morbidly obese. The numbers that she tells us at the beginning of Hunger, of, you know, how many pounds she has are just astounding. You know, how many pounds she had at her fattest. You know, she uses really striking, sometimes, you know, politically incorrect, some people would say, vocabulary to talk about these things openly. And I think even to strike the reader with that kind of language. And then she kind of goes back to tell us how she started eating and why she started binge eating, and what her eating disorder was actually triggered by. And we find out that she was gang raped by a bunch of boys. It was just absolutely horrible to read at the same time but at the same time as also she was treating this with, you know, this kind of this humor. She's funny when she writes. And so I felt that that I have never achieved this kind of sincerity in my life. I don't think I have ever been so sincere and so structured in my thoughts and so able to understand what has been going on with me or the world in such a clear, structured, critical, and intimate way as Roxane Gay has done in Hunger. And when you told me that, when I told you that I started reading, it was like a binge read. I could not let the book down. And then you told me kindly that perhaps I should maybe not read it at once. And I did, and that was very good advice, because I had a nightmare once I put it down. I had a really bad dream. And it's because, you know, it's kind of, it's light and it's humorous in some ways, because she can be very witty, but also self-critical. But on the other hand, she's really talking about some really serious trauma. So it's not easy to read that, but the style is really simple. It's straightforward. And she also writes in very short chapters, which helps out when you're reading it, because they're kind of very, there's like 80 parts or something like that in Hunger, and they're very short, the parts. So it's easy to kind of go through them. They're like bites of a big meal. And so it was really cathartic reading this book. And I just thought that, you know, when I read Roxane Gay, I think this is what I want to write. This is how I would like to write. And I think this is the greatest compliment for a writer.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely understand. It's, I remember that when I read Hunger, I had the same feeling and the same reaction that you're just describing, that you have this impulse to read it, to binge read it, to just read it all at once. But you realize that this is not going to work. For one, you're going to miss out on the feeling that she's trying to convey, all of which you just so beautifully described, that you're supposed to think about it and be repulsed by what happened to her and really think about your own reaction, how you would, you know, act with an overweight person in certain contexts, and how quickly we might be to judge them. And but yeah, like you said, these short sentences and these short paragraphs, they also, I feel, deceptively give the impression that this is a simple read. You know what I mean? Yeah. That this is, you know, just like short, casual paragraphs. And as a writer, I think my reaction all throughout the book was, I would never be able to, I don't think I can write this. I can write like this, or I can write about something like this in this way, like to be so honest and so vulnerable and open. And how do you feel about it? Because you are quite a firecracker, shall we say, especially in your online presence and also in essays that you write. And do you think that her work, like Roxane's work, has already influenced you in certain ways? Because you just said this is how you want to write, this is how you want to approach the subjects that you work on and talk about.
Well, to be perfectly sincere, I don't, and in the manner of the sincerity of Roxane Gay, I don't think that I have achieved that. And I'm not sure that I will. I think I'm way too burdened by social expectations and by my family, to be honest. I don't think that I could be as honest as I would like to, which is what I admire in her, that she's managed to rip those expectations and responsibilities and those burdens that sometimes the people that you love impose on you, even without knowledge. you know, to write such a thing, such something so intimate, and you know, to know that not only the world, but maybe people who judge you more harshly than the world will be able to will read it. It's really brave. And I'm not sure that I can do that. Honestly, you know, reading her made me think, is this why I write fiction? Because really, sometimes I think that I will camouflage some of the things that I feel or that have happened to me. I mean, look, by no means can I, Roxane Gay's story, personal story, is exceptionally traumatic.
That's true.
Yeah. And so I don't want to compare anything like that. I've never gone through any kind of experience like that. Of course, we've all gone through our own experiences and we feel somehow burdened by society or by the expectations of our families. And I particularly feel on myself the burden of gender and the gender roles that I have been asked to perform, made to perform, and also that still carry certain expectations of me. I haven't gotten rid of them. You know, it's an ongoing struggle, and I suffer from these honest and big imperfections. And it feels like Roxane Gay doesn't, even though, you know, at the beginning of Bad Feminist, in the opening essay, she says, you know, I'm not, you know, I'm a bad feminist. Don't put me on your feminist pedestal. You know, I do things that are not very feminist. you know, I make mistakes, and this is very natural, and this is very normal. You know, I'm not here to be an example. And this is so intelligent to say that in such a way that really relieves her of all expectations and allows her to be so honest and so sincere, even about things that could be problematic. You know, when she talks about reality TV, for instance, or some of the trash that she likes, she knows that it's problematic, and then she'll just kind of tell you that it is. But then you're unable to judge her. So she's exceptionally intelligent. And I agree with everything that she says. It's like, sometimes I read her and I think, I can't believe that I fully agree with everything this woman is saying. but no, I don't feel that I have attained, or I'm not sure that even I can attain that level of sincerity that she has. I think this is why she's Roxane Gay, you know, she's an icon to me. And she's going to continue to be, I think, because of these things that she's written. I don't think that she's going to not withstand the test of time.
That's very beautifully put. I agree with everything you say about her, agreeing with everything that she says for you. I wonder, you were just talking about you're burdened by these expectations of society and also by this, I think this issue all of us writers have to some extent of not wanting to hurt people we love or who love us in our writing, and this ongoing conflict. And do you think this is an especially female trait, that we worry too much about what other people think about us?
But it's so hard not to care. I think we have to train ourselves to do that. And I definitely think it's a female characteristic, or it's a characteristic of the gender that we have to perform. I think it's, you know, we're judged so much as children, even as little girls, and we are shamed for our bodies mostly. So it's very difficult. And, you know, our body is, of course, an integral part of who we are, and we can't do anything without our bodies. Yet we are always on display. And someone is always judging us about everything regarding our body. So I think now I'm beginning to feel more comfortable with my body, which is why reading Hunger was so therapeutic and cathartic. But I felt that, you know, when I was growing up, and especially even in my 20s, I think this, I kind of stopped having this feeling the older I got. And I think I had a mental resolution to stop when I turned 30. I said, I cannot live my life by just judging the way I look, because I keep thinking that other people are judging me, which is true, because men were judging our bodies, because it was not possible for me to walk down the street without getting looks or without somehow thinking about how I was walking or what I was wearing. At the age of 12, I got catcalls on the street. So this is not, and I'm not like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you look like. It's just that you're constantly being judged. If you're pretty, if you're not pretty, if you're tall, if you're short, if you're wearing something or not wearing something, it doesn't matter because you're always, if you're out there, you're always being judged. So it's very hard because we've been conditioned to that. And, you know, for that kind of judging, to not conditioned to accept this kind of judging. And so, and then I think that also reflects on everything else. So it's hard not to, to feel fuck that, you know, to feel that I really don't care, but I'm learning, and it's women like Roxane Gay that are helping me out. I think, can I read a part from Hunger about this sort of?
Please, please, please do.
It's about shame. It's connected to what you were asking me. Shame is a difficult thing. People constantly try to shame me for being fat. When I am walking down the street, men lean out of their car windows and shout vulgar things at me about my body, how they see it and how it upsets them that I am not catering to their gaze and their preferences and desires. I try not to take these men seriously because what they are really saying is, I am not attracted to you. I do not want to fuck you. And this confuses my understanding of my masculinity, entitlement, and place in this world. It is not my job to please them with my body, she says. It was a quote. I forgot to say quote unquote, but I think it's pretty clear.
That's okay. It's clear.
Yeah. So it's this, it is not my job to please them with my body. It's not my job to please them with my writing. It's something that we need to keep repeating to ourselves because they are the judges in society. They are literally judges in the courts. They run the countries and they run the policies and they set legislation on our bodies. So of course that we feel threatened or we feel burdened by this. And it's very important to think about not caring about this kind of judgment.
And how does that kind of judgment affect you as a writer? I mean, this is basically at this point, it's just a cliche that as writing women, it's so much harder to be taken seriously in any given literary circle.
I feel kind of privileged to be of that generation of women who can reap the benefits of the previous feminists who came before us and paved the way for us to be able to write so freely and openly and not give a fuck about what critics and men in general say about us.
And that's a really nice sentiment, which I think we don't talk about enough of, that we're part of a tradition that we also, moving forward to a next generation and talking to younger girls especially always makes me very happy to see how much freer they are now and to think that maybe I have like a minuscule thing to do with it. And yeah, I know you feel the same, right?
Right, definitely so. And I feel that we should know that we're part of a tradition or that we're part of a lineage, let's say, a line of these women who were who pushed their way through these literary circles, you know, who became noticed, and now we're reading about them and now we're reading their work. And more frequently than not, I have women writers on my shelves and rather than men writers nowadays, or they're equal. I don't know. I've got the old stuff, and then the new stuff is mostly literature written by women. And it's not that I'm picky in terms of only wanting to read that or like saying, nah, I'm only going to read women. I don't. It's just that it just so happens that this is the type of literature that I'm now interested in and that my friends are reading. And it's also because most of my friends are women, and most of my friends who read are women too, just like I think in general culture. So
I think it's also about what speaks to us, you know. It's I had a conversation a couple of days ago where we were saying with a friend of mine who's an editor, she's a female editor, and we were saying that our generation of women, you know, I've been a bookish person my entire life, you know, from a very young age. And then I went on to have advanced lit classes in school, and then I went on to study literature. And in Germany, of course, you get imposed with this canon of old white dead men, you know, like Thomas Mann and Günter Grass and Max Frisch and all of them, and Goethe and Schiller, of course, you know, all of these supposedly very important poets in German tradition. And you're hammered, this notion that this is literature is hammered into you. And as a bookish person, you kind of feel that, okay, so you're just supposed to learn that this is literature, and you're supposed to learn the parameters that makes this a literary text. And you never question who actually set these rules and who set that canon. The only thing you feel as a young woman of 18, 19, 20 is that you cannot relate to anything that is in these texts. And you just start to feel that, okay, that maybe there's something wrong with you, that there is your notion of what, you know, your life experience is too small to even appear in literature, because all of these supposedly great men who have won Nobel prizes, you know, and are internationally renowned for centuries, they don't speak about your experience. And that I actually myself, I'm now 43. It took me until about a few years ago that I actually just noticed that I never even questioned that. You know, and to see young women today to already approach this question in a completely different way, like there's a generation between us, and that makes me so happy. But I mean, did that happen to you? Like, did you notice very early that you as a woman don't even appear in that literature? Or did you have that similar sort of confusion and just feeling that there's something wrong with you, that you don't understand what these people are talking about?
It was more of the latter. Yeah, I did not. Well, actually, yeah, I did not understand what was going on. I couldn't find myself in any of the texts. And I think I out of nothing else to do, I sometimes identified incorrectly as the muse, which was there in most of the texts that these damaged young men wrote. And they were, you know, a lot of them were anti-heroic men, and as a lot of them wrote about basically themselves, like a thinly veiled version of themselves. And a lot of the time it was just someone who's really deeply fucked up, but is also someone that we would all love to fuck, basically. I think that's a lot of what these poets especially were like. And I thought that I had to be the object of desire. And this is what our professors taught us, and they never looked at it critically. And, you know, it's really weird to nowadays think about how I read Yeats, and how I read Lita and the Swan, for instance. And I sometimes feel shame about those things, but also I don't. I think about Roxane Gay, to come back to her again, who also talks about how she sometimes denounced the idea of being a feminist in her early ages. I think it was denounced. I'm not sure what the word was, because I was translating this essay with my students. But it's this idea that you will not fit in, that you can't be part of the mainstream and people won't like you. And I just tried to fit in. I didn't want to fit in less than I already did. And the only way to fit in is to be one of the boys. So for me, it was like, oh my God, you know, this musy-like thing, but I also wanted to write. And then I kind of got confused in terms of how I should write, you know, and sometimes nowadays I read a lot of literature from Macedonia specifically also, where I see these women writers write specifically from the perspective of a man, even when they have a female narrator, the male gaze is so, so obvious there that you see that the narrator simply wants to be loved and be perceived as someone who is very beautiful and smart. So by that, different, like not other girls. But women nowadays, oh my God, these young girls, I'm so happy when I see how these things have changed. I literally teared up at a forum of these high school girls who invited me for a femme talk. And looking at them like these 17, 16 year old girls who were just so aware of what was going on, and they had read all this literature, and they, you know, oh, I just teared up. I said, oh, I can't believe, you know, we've reached this age where this, you know, where these things are talked about, because no one talked about these things in high school or, you know, at my university in education. It was just not a narrative that you could hear. Of course, yes, there was feminism and critical theory, but it didn't really reach us in the mainstream as well. So it does, you know, I read de Beauvoir, but it wasn't like, you know, I read her when I was 22, 23, and it was just kind of like this, whoo, you suddenly start to read things and to see them, and you certainly realize why you were so angry. And it was gradual for me. I wasn't really woke when I was 23, 24, or whatever. So, but now girls are not like that. And this, I had a really interesting class the other day. We were working on The Great Gatsby. And the first question I asked my students is how they feel about Daisy. And this year I get the answer by my students who say, I don't know. I can't really say that she's that bad. She doesn't have much dialogue. I think, yes, exactly. You know, even regarding, like, I think The Great Gatsby, of course, is a masterpiece. I love that book. But, you know, it's also important to look at it critically and say, okay, this is how women were portrayed. This is why also you can look at it through the aspect of Gatsby just being falling in love with this vacuous woman, because, you know, this is what she's performing her gender, and she cannot have dialogue, and she's not supposed to say anything smart, yet Gatsby's still totally in love with her. So I think this was something that I didn't get back then, but nowadays it's completely new, and I'm really happy to have somehow maybe, you know, contributed through my writing to, just like other women have contributed to, for me to be able to write.
Yeah, I feel the same. And I mean, what you were talking about when you mentioned Simone de Beauvoir is, I feel similarly, I think, because I think I read her first when I started uni, which is probably also 21, 22. And I remember that I somehow understood what she was talking about, but also it just came across as very, how do I say this? Haughty, I guess, you know, like from a perspective of being very high up there, you know, and looking down on things. And I didn't really get the grasp, I think, the whole concept about what she was talking about, because I think I was too young and too much in the traditional gender binary world that we were taught in terms of literature. And to just like circle back to her again for a brief moment, is this is also where someone like Roxane Gay really helps me also, because she's so loud and she's so egalitarian that she talks about so intelligently about literature, the business as such. It's a big thing for her to like, she has her own publishing house now, I think, where she publishes. Yeah, I think she's starting it next year. Where she's going to publish exclusively writers of color and queer people.
Wow.
And it's called Roxane Gay Books. And at the same time, like you also mentioned, like she talks about reality TV, and also quite eloquently. And she starts off Bad Feminist with references to hip hop, to argue that she is a bad feminist because she really enjoys singing along to hip hop in her car. And yeah, I feel like I can relate so much more to that kind of approach, that this incredibly intelligent approach, but not excluding pop culture and the world that surrounds us, you know, and that she's loud about it, which is something I really enjoy in her work.
Absolutely. You know, the thing with reading, you can like to read theory, and then you can also dislike reading theory. And I generally dislike reading theory. And I've generally felt pretty guilty about that, because I didn't like how theory was written. And I didn't like how convoluted it was, and how quotey it was, and how it was all about citations. But I did feel that way about The Second Sex, for instance. And there's also, of course, feminist critical theory that doesn't sound so convoluted, I'll say again. But I realized that you can be very well informed, and you can posit hypotheses, and you can prove things and discuss them intelligently by being very, very simple in the way you express yourself. And this is what Roxane Gay does. And for me, this is really important because I love simplicity. I totally dig it. I dig it in literature, and I also dig it in nonfiction. So, and this is what she does. I think she explains things in very simple ways that are just incredibly bright and intelligent and understandable to other things, to other people. She can reach, I think, a wider audience through in the way in which she expresses herself, which I believe is very hard. I think it's much easier to write, a long, flowy and complicated sentence rather than what she does. So, and then this is also tied into the examples that she gives us. She, as you said, she begins Bad Feminist with talking about how, you know, she listens to hip hop in her car and, you know, she sings along with it. And I'm not sure if she said car, but I also imagine her singing in her car. But, you know, I think she's, she's constantly, the essays that she's writing, she's always drawing examples from pop culture. And with that, she's leveling, I think, the ground of, you know, what's an intellectual and what, you know, this kind of haughty white culture is and what the rest of us, you know, and where we can analyze things and where we can see how we can see society reflected and even, you know, even in pop culture. And I love pop culture, and let's give it the importance and the significance or the place that it deserves. And she does not stray away from that significance. So I think she's brilliant in terms of commenting on current issues. And that's a lot of what Bad Feminist does. I think in almost every essay, she talks about something current. Like, I don't know, she talks about very intelligently about shows like Girls and Orange is the New Black and Tarantino. I have to say this, look. I have to read this part. So I have this thing with Tarantino. I kept trying to tell people why I dislike him so much. And then I read this essay about Django Unchained. And then she says this, she just puts it so simply and eloquently. As with Inglourious Basterds using World War II, Tarantino once again managed to find a traumatic cultural experience of a marginalized people that has little to do with his own history and used that cultural experience to exercise his hubris for making farcically violent, vaguely funny movies that set to right historical wrongs from a very limited, privileged position. And this is also what he does in Kill Bill with women. You know, a woman is taking revenge on a man. And this is supposed to right all the wrongs of men wronging women and raping them and beating them and, you know, committing femicide because of jealous reasons. And, oh, but now we're going to turn it into something fun where we see hot women killing each other. So, she's able to argue these points very intelligently. And also she does that about reality shows, which is just brilliant.
If you had one question, like, let's just indulge in the fantasy that we actually managed to meet her, which I feel like we should manifest that at some point we will. What would you ask her? Or would you just try and repress the impulse to hug her and say, thank you for everything you've done for us? I think this is what would happen to me. Like, I would just turn into this absolutely groupy mess and probably couldn't even think straight, I guess.
Oh God, you know, I have, of course, like you, I have fantasies of meeting my heroes and, or shall I say heroines. And now that I have fans myself, I imagine sometimes that maybe my fans also feel that. And then I kind of cringe because because I really, sometimes I see how they want me to notice them and probably, you know, when you see someone that you like, or you've watched them, you've read them, you've lived with them in your head, you probably want their attention. And I think for me, it would be very important to kill that that urge to be noticed by her, which I find ridiculous, you know. And I find something a ridiculous human characteristic, to be honest. You know, this urge to be somehow noticed by important people. I love this scene in my life. I keep telling it to people, and every time I see a woman dancing in public, I always imagine that. I imagine this woman. There was this writer, and we were on this translation workshop together, or she was a writer and a translator, just like myself. And there was this really important rich guy who showed up at the hotel with an entourage of these, what should I call him? Well, like slaves of his. They were literally there just to kind of, like, parasites surrounding him and telling him how great he was. And then she suddenly, somebody started playing the piano. And suddenly she just started dancing this bad ballet amidst the tables of the huge restaurant of this old socialist hotel. And I thought, oh my God, this is just so humiliating. This desire to be noticed and then being noticed by everyone else that you're trying to get noticed is really humiliating. So, and it's funny. So I would try not to do that. And not burden her perhaps with my questions. I would honestly probably just say that I learned from her and that her prose truly means a lot to her. And I would resist the urge to hug her because I know that she hates.
She hates physical contact, and she hates taking pictures. And you're much more evolved and grown up than I am. I would just be like, oh my God, I love you so much. But I mean,
well, that's better, actually. Just saying that, then I love you so much and I really love what you do is better, you know, and just going away after that. Because really, that person does not have the time to deal with you.
Yeah, and also she probably heard every single question in the universe that is, because I mean, she's an international superstar. Is she popular in Macedonia, by the way, or in the Balkans? Because I mean, this is something that really baffles me. Her work is translated to German, but somehow, I mean, she doesn't really, seem to break through in the same way that she does in the English speaking world, which, you know, again, speaks to German conservatism.
Yeah. You know, with Macedonia, it's very difficult to say what is popular because it's a very, very small country. So let's say the last census we had, I think there's like 1.8 million of us. And that's a very small population. We're a relatively new country. Well, not relatively, but it's new. It's post-Second World War. The language was standardized also in 1945. So everything is kind of new. And at certain points, we go through trends, you know, like comic books or French surrealism or, I don't know, magic realism. That was a thing for a while. And I think it has to do with people who are important translators or writers or somehow scholars that have put forward these trends, because the country is so small that you literally individuals can be trendsetters. Sometimes there's, and you know, what is popularity? People, 500 people reading it, because that's how much a print run is, 500. And that's a lot, you know, that's very normal for any country when you set the standards of what the population is. And then when you compare it to the print run. So, but no, she's not popular even by those norms because she has not been published. And then it comes to publishing policies and generally the politics of translation, and also how writers from abroad feel about getting translated and published in countries like Macedonia. And I told you, but I had a very unpleasant conversation with Rebecca Solnit's agents, who I just asked in terms of the how much the copyright would cost for some of her books. And they didn't even want to give me an answer because they said that they wanted to go for big publishing houses, which in Macedonia is ridiculous because they're not going to, you know, the reason why I asked is because I run this feminist organization, let's say, that is connected to storytelling, which is just exactly what Rebecca Solnit is talking about. And she's always very outspoken about supporting you know, these kind of non-capitalist ventures. Yet her publishers are saying, sorry, we don't even want to consider what you're asking us because we want to go with a big publishing house. And that just really killed me. And it was so, I was so disappointed by that. I felt, oh my God, I've been reading this woman and she's the opposite of everything that I'm actually, that I've been thinking that, or maybe her agents are, but it doesn't matter, that her agents represent that policy. So, you know, sometimes it has to do with, you know, just generally the money that you have to pay. Not publishing houses in Macedonia don't have 600, 700, 1,000, 1,500 euros to give a particular writer. And sometimes the agents will just go, sorry, we don't have that kind of, if you don't have that kind of money, we won't publish you. And then, you know, a lot of the publishers, they just don't want to publish. So, you know, when you're a poor country and you suffer from this kind of disprivilege, underprivilege, whatever it is, it's very difficult to get things through. And it's a vicious circle. It's what happens to all kinds of marginalized communities. And I would think that it would be different with Roxane Gay, but for that, you'd have to contact her or her agents and see what they have to say. You know, if they can just kind of, I think that for messages like these, women, especially women of color or women in general, I just have to say, should waive their rights to third world countries. I mean, what kind of money are you looking at making? What, 600 euros? What is that for you? For someone like I don't know, Rebecca Solnit, what do you make out of 600 euros? So I don't know. I think that would be more in line with their policies. But then again, there's not a lot of publishing houses that would like to do that. I don't know. I think I'm gonna try, you know, I'm talking a lot about her here and I'm translating her with my students. So I'm trying to kind of get people hooked on her at least.
That's actually a really interesting idea that you just mentioned. Maybe that is something we should work on, like write about it, to waive translation rights for certain countries or certain regions in the world where we feel like their work would make a difference, but publishers are not privileged enough to acquire the translation rights. That's actually a really interesting idea. You just gave me an idea. I might actually do something with that. But yeah, also maybe, I mean, this is what I sometimes feel in terms of especially translations from the English, and especially with someone like Roxane Gay, who's so online, like she's on Twitter, I think 24/7, and she has this really vivid Instagram and she's all over the internet. And that especially to a younger generation, maybe it's just that, you know, you follow this person and you like we do too, you know, we follow this person and their work. I, you know, we subscribe to her newsletter that she's started during the pandemic and basically yeah, get access to everything she does via her own channels and her own social media presence. And then because especially you and I, we're able to read her work in English, so we buy the English books. And I would presume that especially younger generation now, like young women now in their 20s, that they would do the same, you know. Maybe this is there's especially in Germany still a very, very big dissonance between what actually gets mentioned in your classic reviews on the radio or in the newspaper. Who even reads those anymore, you know, and what happens online and on social media and in blogs and podcasts. So it's very difficult to tell how popular someone really is. I just think that I don't see her books in bookshops, you know. This is always a measuring stick for me to go into a bookshop and see, okay, are there her books on the table, you know. So I'm just assuming. Yeah. That hopefully we've now introduced a maybe a little bit wider readership in Germany of younger, hopefully also men and women, to our heroine, Roxane Gay. Last words about yes, and there's her. Cheer to tell everybody how fantastic she is.
There's this essay that I'm going to translate with my students next, which is called Peculiar Benefits. It's about privilege. And for me, the discussion on privilege is really important because I get very frequently slapped with aggression when I tell someone that they are privileged. And I have myself been aggressive about it. And I was not able to accept my privilege when I was told that I had it. And I think, you know, for people, the essay is written in such an intelligent, open way that doesn't, that tells us that, she says this, we need to get to a place where we discuss privilege by way of observation and acknowledgement rather than accusation. And essentially she just tells people, look, you just have to own your privilege and there's nothing that you have to do about it, except own it, except acknowledge that it exists. And you don't even have to apologize for it, because I sometimes find myself having to apologize for it, which is really, I feel kind of stupid for doing that, because, you know, I didn't also choose that kind of privilege, and I'm trying to, yes, acknowledge it and maybe do something where I can help, I don't know, work for social justice or something like that, or, you know, point out some inequalities in the world or do something, not just kind of be like, you know, abusing the privilege that I have. But I think at one point, but she says also this really important thing about privilege, which I loved, you know, we would live in a world of silence if the only people who were allowed to write or speak from experience or about difference were those absolutely without privilege. Because it seems sometimes that as a writer, I do get attacked for, you know, how about this position, or why are you writing, you know, you're writing from a position of privilege and you're writing about the things that you know, or the things that, you know, that could be seen as privileged. And I think that that's also an unfair position, but it's very murky, because on the other hand, excluding everything and just writing only about this kind of bubble of privilege can also be kind of complicated. But the way in which he talks about these things is really, really intelligent, and I encourage you to read them. One essay in Bad Feminist that I liked that talks about this kind of privilege and is Girls, Girls, Girls. And then you can read it against this one called, what was it called? Peculiar Benefits, which is really one of my favorite essays that she's written.
See, with everything you just said, I could just like open the next layer of this discussion that you and I could undoubtedly have for another couple of hours, because, you know, everything you just said about acknowledgement, I feel like acknowledgement is the mother of all moving forward, shall we say. You know, this is, I mean, you know, I write and work a lot about racism, and Germany has a massive problem acknowledging the fact that there is such a thing deep rooted in our society. And I feel like if this country, this society, people could just acknowledge that it's there, we could all move forward. But you just frequently get into these discussions also on sexism, obviously, you know, on misogyny, that the people in power are unwilling to accept that it's there. Which means that you would level with people who are affected by these systems. So it's great to have someone write these essays and give us the vocabulary as such, you know, to and
exactly
formulate the thoughts in a very comprehensive and intelligent, as you said, way for us. I mean, this is something that helps me greatly to see she's giving me a toolkit to talk about the things that I feel I want to talk about in my work. So yeah, that's probably the greatest thing she's done for me.
You know, there's another thing, like I have to mention this. When someone does not acknowledge their privilege, I feel like they're gaslighting you or whoever has suffered because of that particular privilege or because of a lack of privilege. And for, as a woman, you know, when someone tells me, well, you know, I don't have privilege because I'm a man, I'm also, and then, you know, always white men have these long discussions about why they're not privileged and why I am just as privileged as themselves. And I could freely walk out at night and, you know, take a run or something. It's like bullshit. And I feel horribly gaslit at that moment. And I feel really angry when they just say, oh, when they just don't listen and acknowledge what's going on. Like once I remember there was a breakthrough point with my father where I was complaining about how I was raised and how my brother never had to do any housework. And I had to do all the kind of girlish things in the house, or and it was so deeply unfair that it still pains me to think about. But no one acknowledged it. They kept telling me that I was in fact inventing things, or that there was a reason why this was so. And at one point, my dad, he turned around, he looked at me, and he said, "Well, you know, we are a patriarchal family. You know, this is what it was. We were like that." And I thought, "Oh my God, thank you. Thank you for telling me that, you know, for acknowledging that you were a patriarchal family." And I felt somehow that, you know, I was not, they weren't telling me that I was crazy anymore. So it's really important that all you do is just say, yes, that's true. And listen to the people who have had perhaps different problems or more problems than you've had in your life. And that's all, that's all it takes. So I don't know. It's really, I feel that every once in a while I go back and, you know, like I look at some quotes or, you know, some things from Bad Feminist and I go, yeah, let me remember how to say things that I need to say. Because really, if you are a person who's speaking up openly in society about things, she is a very good guide as to how to express yourself sincerely, critically, but also not in a way that offends other people.
And very clear. Like she has this amazing gift for clarity, which I think also helped me greatly evolve, and my, especially in the essay writing. So thank you so much for talking to me and for doing this on the record, what we usually do in private. And I feel like we did her. We made her proud, I hope.
I hope so. I'm not going to imagine that she's going to listen to this podcast.
Of course not. But I mean, let's just indulge in the fantasy. No, I mean, she cannot possibly keep up, but I hope we did her justice. And thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you. Thank you for having this show and for inviting me. It was, as always, a pleasure. And I hope to see you soon in person.
We will.